Binge Mode is brought to you by DirecTV Now. Live stream your favorite channels on virtually any device. Plus, you can subscribe to HBO and start watching Game of Thrones today. Lord Baelish.
Peter, please.
Are you heading to listen to Binge Mode?
I'm going to the Eyrie to see your Aunt Lysa in the Veil.
She's sensitive, so I feel compelled to tell you that Binge Mode features adult content.
Good, good.
Very graphic at times.
Good.
I know how she is around Moondoor, so wanted to warn you, just in case. And now, here's Binge Mode.
If they catch you, they'll put your head on a spike just like my father's. You'd risk that just to confuse them.
So many men, they risk so little. They spend their lives avoiding danger. Then they die. I'd risk everything to get what I want.
And what do you want?
Everything.
Hello!
Yeah.
And welcome to Binge Mode. I'm Mallory Rubin, deputy editor of TheRinger.com. Joining me today, now that he's finished a late night cuddle session with Sir Pounce.
Sir Pounce?
Oh, you're a papa fellow. It's Ringer staff writer and your maester, Jason Concepcion.
Hello.
Jason.
Hi.
We don't want to fight pretty.
No.
We want to win.
Absolutely.
We are rewatching all 60 episodes of Game of Thrones, deep diving one at a time. Requisite spoiler warning. We will be going deep on details from the show and the books from this season and beyond. So grow strong, because it's time to break down season 4, episode 4, Oathkeeper.
Guys, there's nothing more tedious than a trial, especially when they could end in death. Except perhaps for these gardens. So let's keep things interesting by offering a brief refresher on what actually happened in this fourth installment by taking a quick trip down our very own King's Road.
Marine!
Great place!
We love Marine.
Slaver's Bay!
We love it. Grey Worm and a cadre of Unsullied disguise themselves as common slaves. They slip through the gates into the city, arm and organize the slaves of Marine into a revolutionary force to take down the masters. Marine falls, Dany's banner hanging from the harpy above the Great Pyramid. What does Dany do with the survivors? We'll talk about that more a little later on.
In King's Landing, after some guilt tripping from Bronn, Jaime visits Tyrion in the dungeon. You still haven't seen him yet, have you? He asks Tyrion whether he killed Joffrey. Tyrion asks Jaime to spray him from the poke. Jaime refuses, obviously, for now. Olenna tells Margaery just enough to let her know that recent events, as troubling as they appear, are firmly under her control. She encourages Marge to make Tommen hers before Cersei can interfere. Marge makes a late night visit with the aid of a furry friend to the new king.
Proper fellow. I just realized that we're using OSHA's "That's a big man" voice to talk about a cat. That's a proper fellow.
Cersei isn't happy with Jaime. Why? Well, she feels the security around King Tommen is inadequate. Why? Well, her other son, formerly the king, kind of died while nominally under the protection of Jaime and the rest of the King's Guard. So, you know, she's a little sensitive about this. She wants more guards at Tommen's door. Also,
classic, you have one job.
Also,
move from Cersei.
Also, you know, kind of suspicious why Kat Stark let Jaime go, and she questions Jaime about this. It turns out maybe Cersei is kind of right about a few things. Jaime hasn't forgotten his promise to Kat. He gives Brienne the sword, soon to be known as Oathkeeper, and a new suit of armor, and a new squire. She sets out with Pod to find Sansa Stark, and if she's alive, Arya.
Another great pairing. Another great Game of Thrones pairing. Todd and Bran. Love it. Guys.
Yes.
In the sea on the way to the Vale. Littlefinger. Peter. Quizzes Sansa. Who do you think killed the king?
Yeah.
And why? He is grooming her for a life of lies and perhaps some other things. Eventually, he reveals his Littlefingered hand in the scheme to assassinate the king. Sort of dances around who his partners might be. If you're paying attention, you'll notice that he says, grow strong, and then the show cuts right to the Tyrells.
At Castle Black in the north, John is training up his brothers for the upcoming battle. Among the fresh recruits are Ollie, the lone survivor of a village attacked by Tormund, Ygritte and the Wildlings, and Locke, who we know is there on a mission from the Boltons to kill Jon Snow and locate the Stark boys. Jon O'Slynt encourages Thorne to sanction Jon's mission to Craster's. It's a win-win. If he dies, can't become a threat in the coming Night's Watch election. Jon asks for volunteers to go north of the Wall, and much to Slint and Thorne's shock, Snow has no shortage of fighters willing to accompany him, including Locke.
Craster's Keep, north of the Wall. Not great, guys. Things are really bad here.
It's a bad place.
It is pretty awful. Carl and his fellow mutineers are raping. They're killing. It is disgraceful and disgusting, though we are treated to a pretty excellent line of dialogue from our good friend Carl Tanner from Gin Alley. Drinking wine from the skull of G.R. fucking Mormont. Man, great stuff. Ghost, my pal Ghost, one of my favorite characters, languishing in a cage outside. This is very upsetting. Rast, acting on Carl's orders, delivers Craster's
for the gods.
Last son.
For the gods.
To the White Walkers. Gift for the gods. Gift for the gods. Bran, the twins, Hodor, Summer, they hear that baby's cries. And after a brief investigation using Summer, who is then also falls into a trap, they are captured by the mutineers. Bran, in an effort to save Mira's life, admits who he is. And who is he? A very high-value hostage. In the closing scene, a White Walker takes the child north and north and north again to the lands of Always Winter, which Jason will be telling us much more about later on in this episode.
Mal, unlike Carl, we never thought this was going to be a boring day. Carl from Gin Alley. The Purple Wedding fallout is still in full effect and the chess pieces are in motion. And that gets us to the episode's big idea, so let's get right to the core of it by sticking it with the pointy end. The defining theme of this episode is the pawns on the board. All across this episode, the powerless are either deployed to do someone else's bidding or encouraged to break free of those chains. Some of the kings and queens and bishops and knights and rooks are viciously deploying pawns as shields and fall guys, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Others are breaking convention to defend those who can't defend themselves. Let's start with the latter sort, Dany in Meereen.
Interesting scene in Meereen. We open there with Grey Worm, and he is attempting to learn the common tongue. Missandei is teaching him. He claims that he doesn't really remember life.
He's going to be using that common tongue. A lot of common tongue in season 7.
Grey Worm's entire identity now is really tied up in, you know, on the one hand, fighting for Dany because he wants to help those who are being used as pawns. Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, in trying to take down the people who are using others as pawns, the masters. Kill the masters. So when Grey Worm and his fellow Unsullied sneak through the source to make their pitch to the slaves of Meereen, they find that those folks are already having a meeting. They are already engaged in this discussion. And Mazador, one of the younger slaves who will take on a slightly bigger role in this season, is asking his elderly companions, you want to live the rest of your days in chains? And Grey Worm makes a pitch off of that pitch.
Right.
He says, no one can give you your freedom, brothers. If you want it, you must take it. He's learning from Dany.
Yep.
This is her message, right? If you want to stop being a pawn, you have to make yourself another piece on the board. You have to make that decision. And it works, right? The slaves rebel. Grey Worm gives them weaponry and they rebel. They take down the masters. We see the Targaryen banner flying from atop the Great Pyramid. But that is not a wrap on the action here because Dany wants to solidify what has occurred here. She wants to solidify her chess win. Nailing the masters to cross.
Wow.
Like they had done, right, with the 163 slaves that she saw along the road to Meereen, which we, as that was happening, we saw how that affected her, the way that her plan and her agenda was completely confirmed and solidified in that moment. She is now acting on the promise that she made to herself, right? This concerns Ser Barristan. This is a notable moment here. He says, sometimes it's better to answer injustice with mercy. And then Dany delivers one of what will become her iconic lines.
Yeah.
I will answer injustice with justice. She does not want to be anyone's pawn anymore. And even if that kind of tunnel vision and that really rigid thinking, it is to her detriment at times, right? But here's what I want to ask you.
Yeah.
Shades of the Mad Queen? Because this is dark, dark shit. She thinks it's justice. She thinks she's acting in justified fashion. But what is too far? What is justice? And what is clearly you are the daughter of the Mad King?
I think these are hints of that kind of Targaryen sprinkle of madness that even the most stable Targaryen rulers had. They all had something about them that was, you know, at a minimum interesting about their personalities. Right. You know, Rhaegar loved to play the harp and sing songs and stuff, as well as fight. So I think that, you know, at this point, it is mildly concerning, but at the same time, I think it's a logical move because let's, you know, like a house divided against itself will not stand. It has to be either one thing or the other. Slaver's Bay cannot exist as a culture that's part freedmen and the former slave masters who once owned them together in one place. It's not going to work, guys, especially in a short time frame. It's either got to be one thing or it's got to be the other. And I think in order for that to happen, Dany has to show her strength and show that she's deciding it's going to be this other thing. And if you disagree with her, you're going to get nailed to a plank and set up against the road.
It is disturbing when we see her just listening to her conquered foes screaming.
She likes
from atop the pyramid. Weird. Like, I know some people like prefer like whale sounds or other kind of like soothing white noise before bed. No, Dany wants to hear the screaming.
Well, I will say that at least learning about cringe, she's visiting justice, at least, you know, for real. This is not the kind of same thing about, you know, when she was kind of squeamish back in the Lazarine village in season one. Those people had not done anything. Well, whereas the masters, you know, had enslaved millions and were crucifying children.
Right. How about Jaime? We have a couple interesting Jaime pairings in this episode. Let's start with Jaime and Tyrion here.
This is a great pairing because here are two people who have resisted being pawns for their whole lives, essentially. Jaime's, the defining moments of his life have been him rejecting the things that his father has wanted for him. Tyrion, meanwhile, is somewhat of an expert at getting people to do things for him. After Bronn convinces Jaime to finally visit Tyrion, you know, the two brothers have a chat. The Kingslayer brothers, do you like it?
I like it.
It's nice little icebreaking.
Catchy.
Jaime wants to help, which is wonderful. And also, like, their relationship is super interesting. The fact that Jaime is madly in love with Cersei, and Cersei hates Tyrion with a burning passion since he was a baby. So this is an interesting relationship.
Right.
He wants to help, but he's Lord Commander of the Kingsguard, you know?
Bit of a complication.
Yeah, he also Cersei's lover. Not a lot he can do. How can I help? He says, well, you can set me free, Tyrion, cutting right to the point. No, I can't. And then Tyrion says, you know, then there's really nothing else to say. I'm Lord Commander of the Kingsguard, he says, you know. Sorry, I'd nearly forgotten. I'd hate for you to do something inappropriate. Yeah, and
so
Jaime, smartly, freeing you is treason. He's in a really tough position. He wants to help his brother. He wants to be there for his brother. But his life is set up in such a way that it is impossible. The only way to do it is to reject everything that is normal, semi-normal, and stable about his life. So yet again, Jaime Lannister rejecting being a pawn.
Which makes his interaction with Brienne in this episode particularly insightful because Cersei makes him feel like a pawn.
Right.
When they're having the exchange about Tommen's protection and the way guards are being deployed, and she dismisses him by saying, that will be all Lord Commander.
Yeah.
That obviously makes him feel like shit. So he chooses to take action, to not allow himself to be a pawn. And he calls Brienne, right? They're going through the Book of Brothers, and he says it's the duty of the Lord Commander to fill those pages. Remember, these are the same pages that Joffrey previously mocked.
Must have been extremely painful. Like, think about how—
Clearly it left a mark.
Yeah, think about having to write that in the book. Jaime Lannister, knighted to the Kingsguard at 16, killed the king, ever after known as the Kingslayer. Right.
And then you're just...
That's it.
That's it.
You've done nothing else.
Right. You're waiting.
You've lost two kings, in fact, since then.
Not a great resume.
No.
Not a great CV.
No.
Gotta be honest. That's not gonna work on LinkedIn, buddy. And he says to Brienne, there's still rune left in mine, right? Mm. He gifts her the Valyrian steel sword that Tywin gave him at the beginning of this season, the one that was made from ice. And he says to her, he explains, right? This was forged from Ned Stark's sword. You'll use it to avenge Ned Stark's daughters. This is beautiful.
Yeah.
Brienne is clearly, she's not only, I mean, first she goes to the whole, I can't, you shouldn't have. You shouldn't have. Valyrian steel, you shouldn't
what?
Have. But, you
this
know.
Is like someone giving you like $500 billion and a fucking island.
This is Wags giving Axe the coin to the VR post-apocalyptic vault. And ultimately, Brienne is not only incredibly impressed with this, the decision Jaime has made to honor this pledge to Kat, but she is empowered, right? She says, I'll find her, being Sansa. For Lady Catelyn, pause.
Yeah.
And for you. This is extremely touching, right? He then gifts her with some extremely dope armor.
Yeah.
Hope I got the measurements right. And then the best gift of all, guys, Pod. He gives her Pod as a squire. Now, there's a lot of comedy in this scene. It is very amusing. Like, Bronn is there too. So he's like, you know, what are you waiting for? A kiss? Like,
right.
Get the lady swords
let's
ready.
Go.
But what is Jaime actually doing here? He sees how many different people he can help in this one move. Tyrion is worried about Pod. Putting Pod in this position
Boom.
helps take that off of Tyrion's mind. Pod is in danger. Syncing him up with Brienne allows Pod to leave King's Landing and escape whatever harm might await him. And this also gives Brienne, though she might not be viewing it this way at the time, another body, you know, assistance, a right hand, a squire. And then we have... Our producer Zach always yells at me for saying everything is a top five moment. He's like, you know, 745 things can't all be top five moments. But this is definitely up there. They say the best swords have names. Any ideas? That's Jaime to Brienne. And she says, Oathkeeper. There is not a more meaningful thing that a person could say to Jaime. He looks almost on the verge of tears. It truly, truly touched. Like somebody is seeing him and understanding him and believing in him, really, for the first time. So many feelings. I love it.
Littlefinger and Sansa, the chess master and the ultimate pawn. His Joffrey death explanation hinges heavily on ascribing basically how he used Sansa and Dantos as pawns to deliver the necklace. This is a Littlefinger trademark. He enjoys flaunting the intricacy of his schemes on people that he knows can't really grasp them unless he tells them. You know, like if you build something.
Wants to show his work.
He did it with Ned, remember, in the garden. That's my spies over there, and there's this one, and also this one. You know, like, he loves to do this. And of course, to him, everyone is a piece to be moved. And the genius of Littlefinger is he doesn't look like a chess master, or he doesn't play himself off like he's just I'm just a humble master of coins / owner of various brothels. What could, you know, I'm from a very, very minor area of the Vale. Like, what could I possibly do? And when Sansa asked why he'd betray the Lannisters, who gave him wealth, power, who gave him the cursed seat of Harrenhal, we get the latest insight into his thought process. A man with no motive is a man no one suspects. Always keep your foes confused. I'd risk everything to get what I want. And what do you want? And then Littlefinger stares at her.
Goes in for the shoulder grab. Yeah,
male gaze hard for like 35 seconds. Everything. Now, if you'll excuse me, I need to be alone with myself for no longer than 2 minutes. Yeah, Littlefinger he's relishing this. He's enjoying this. Because you think about it, he's been making moves this whole time. But it's very rare that he's gotten to flaunt the beauty of his schemes.
So rare, in fact, that even though the core pillar of his philosophy, or one of them, obviously one of them is Chaos is a Ladder, is keep him guessing.
Yeah.
Right? he not only is explaining, basically play by play, what he just did and why, he's explaining what he's about to do in the future, right? He says, I'm going to let you do this because you're... Your little finger impression is tremendous, but he goes on to sketch out the new alliance and why it's beneficial to him.
And he doesn't, notable that he doesn't trust her enough yet to really out his partners. He wants her to know, you know, this is all part of a larger scheme with other people, but I don't want to really tell you who those people are. My friendship with the Lannisters was productive, but Joffrey, a vicious boy with a crown on his head, is not a reliable ally. Who could trust a friend like that?
Who could trust you?
I don't want friends like me. My new friends are predictable, very reasonable people. As for what happened to Joffrey, well, that was something my new friends wanted very badly. Nothing like a thoughtful gift to make a new friendship
grow strong.
Ding, 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 ding. Do you think Sansa picked up on that? Does she know the words of the various... This is not even like knowing... Random. This is a major house of the realm. It's like saying nothing like a thoughtful gift to make my to make a new friendship always pay its debts.
No, wait, what would be the most obvious ones? Nothing. Nothing like a new friendship to.
Winter is coming.
It's great. And, you know, he basically is saying to her there, to the extent that she's absorbing it, right? Like, he gave up on the Lannisters because he didn't think that he could use Joffrey as a pawn in
his
game.
Well-read.
He does think he can use the Tyrells that way. And so let's get to the Tyrells, right? Because the show cuts right from him saying grow strong to Olenna and Margaery. How are those new friends that Littlefinger is talking about doing, right? Well... He might view them as pliable companions, but that is definitely not how they think of themselves.
No.
Or at least not how Olenna thinks of them, right? She shares a racy little tale with Margaery about how she used sex to secure the marriage that she wanted back in the day, right? I was to be given to some Targaryen or other.
I love that she's, won't even, like, what a humble brag, by
it's
the way.
It's so great.
Ah, one of the Targaryens, I don't even know where.
Yes, one of those silver-haired, violet-eyed assholes. Marrying a Targaryen was all the rage back then, she says, right? But this isn't what she wanted to happen. So she took matters into her own hands. And what was the result? Well, as she shares with Margaery, the following morning, Luther, this is the dude she fucked.
Yeah.
Never made it down the stairs to propose to my sister because the boy couldn't bloody walk.
She worked that shit.
Here's the zinger, though. And once he could, the only thing he wanted was what I'd given him the night before.
Wow.
Incredible. Now, obviously just an iconic reveal and line, but she isn't just bragging,
right?
Even though she obviously deserves to. She is teaching Margaery a lesson. Do not allow yourself to be a pawn in someone else's game. Take action.
Yes.
Assume agency so that you can make other people your pawns, right? She says, I was good. I was very, very good. What a queen. Oh, my God. You are even better. So you need to act quickly. Cersei may be vicious, but she's not stupid. She'll turn the boy, Tommen, against you as soon as she can, and by the time you're married, it'll be too late, right? Act. And she points out, luckily, Cersei's a little distracted dealing with the death of Joffrey,
right? A lot of things going on.
Accusing her own brother of murder, et cetera. And then she says, which he didn't commit. Marge.
Yeah, what?
Like, what? Well, he could have. He could have, but he didn't. You don't know, grandmother. Oh, but I do. You don't think I'd let you marry that beast, do you? Right? Marjorie's like, I don't understand what's happening right now. Which is a little, I guess this is, it's a little uncharacteristic for Margaery, but also this is so, so shocking.
It would be mind-blowing that it's like, wait a second, my granny killed the king? Wait.
What? So, and Olenna sort of puts a bow on this by saying, you know, shh, don't worry yourself about all that. You just do what needs to be done. Well, and then the camera kind of lingers on Olenna touching Marjorie's necklace, just to cement for any viewer who hasn't fully pieced this together at this point. Olenna and Littlefinger conspired to kill the king using Dantos and Sansa in the necklace. Okay, it is confirmation of her role in Joffrey's assassination, right? But it is also a lot of pawn planning here, and Margaery does not wait long to act. She visits Tommen in his chambers, which pretty easy to enter.
Cersei, I think, listen, Cersei is a terrible person, but she
not
has
wrong.
A point.
Not wrong about needing more guards.
You know, if Margaery in like her silken gown can steal into the king's chambers in the middle of the night, the security is bad.
She is using her sex appeal, obviously, but also a subtler tactic, right? Secrets, companionship.
Keep this between us.
We can have a little thing here. We can have a bond, right? She literally says to him, because he's like, my mother...
I can't even describe the look on his face.
He's sweating. He's terrified. And you literally can just see the words flashing across his face like, Sir Pounce, I need you to move 6 inches to the left and hide my boner. That's what's going through his mind right now. And she says to him, right, it can be our secret.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If we're going to be man and wife, we'll have a few secrets from her, I hope. You know, Olenna, her lesson instantly resonated, and Margaery, as usual, took action effectively.
Night's Watch and the Mutineers. The Night's Watch, an interesting body of men, because it's essentially the pawns who were taken or who were lost. Slint encourages Thorne to use John as a pawn. The bastard's well-liked. You're not.
Good advice.
Good advice. You can't be acting commander forever. There will be a choosing. Interesting. Because the Night's Watch, there's an election whenever they need a new Lord Commander. The old Meister will insist on it. You might reconsider his request to march on Craster's. Let the Mutineers take care of Snow. Or you might be taking orders from him for the rest of your life. Thorne sanctions John's mission to eliminate the Mutineers before Mance finds them, but volunteers only. And I think this is a troubling development for Thorne and Slint. You know, they weren't, I think when Gren and Ed volunteer, it's like, okay, those are John's.
They're buddies.
They're John's friends. But when the
Not
other
that
guy.
Coward Pip.
Yeah, but when they get like 10 other dudes, this is a problem.
Well, it's confirmation of what Slint just said.
Yeah, like, and also, like, you know, you just got 10 guys to volunteer to go beyond the wall where everyone knows a massive wildling army is there somewhere. No one knows exactly where. Also, the White Walkers are back. And, also, you've got to go take out formerly your brothers. And people are like, yeah, sure, Jon Snow, okay. This would shake them. But guess who one of these volunteers is? Locke. And speaking of the Mutineers, Kyle Tenna from Gin Alley. You know, what a fucking piece of shit he is. But when he's drinking wine from the skull of fucking G.R. Mormont, he asks the skull if it has any commands. You know, what's that? Fuck them till they're dead. The classic Carl Tanner line.
Charming fellow.
This is what happens when a pawn is tired of being a pawn, but only has anger to drive him. Only anger and brutality and violence to drive them forward. Not intelligence, not anything to temper this violence. He's just bragging about his past life as a well-paid pawn. You know how much they paid me to kill a man in King's Landing? 7 silvers. And Carl is using Rast as his pawn. Goading him, you know, go feed the dog. Go feed Ghost, the beast. And taking Craster's last male heir into the woods because, you know, like, that seems like something I don't want to do. Why don't you do that, Rast? And it's effective. Rast is a monster, of course. Also a violent bully. But he's not a leader. He's a follower. Bran, Mira, Jojen, Hodor, they hear the baby scream. And Bran wargs into Summer to see what's up. Summer gets caught in the trap. And once they're captured... What is the only thing that kind of tempers Carl's lust for violence and domination for even just a second? It's realizing that, I just stumbled into some very valuable pawns. I can exchange these guys for riches.
This is nice leather. You must be a little lord, right?
And he's, you know, because he was about to kill Mira when Bran is like, I'm Bran Stark. And from there on, we go to the ultimate pawn, Craster's last son. How was Craster surviving all these years? He was helping to build up the White Walker's strength.
Hey guys, just a quick break to tell you about our sponsor. Binge Mode is brought to you by DirecTV Now. Live stream your favorite channels on virtually any device. Plus, you can subscribe to HBO and start watching Game of Thrones today. And now, back to Binge Mode. Carl wants to give the walkers what they want. And we want to give Binge Mode enthusiasts everywhere what they want. And that is insight into what the hell we saw at the end of this episode. Let's not forget. Let's take a step back here.
Yeah.
Go back in time and remember the shock and joy that greeted this scene when it first aired. This was mesmerizing and stunning because it was new, right? Yep. None of the books that have been published to date feature a trip to the lands of Alwaeswinter or the transformation of a baby into a mini White Walker. There are hints. You're going to talk about some of those hints more. There are glimpses, but not a full scene. And this was a huge expansion of the world and a huge insight into what the arch villains of the story are actually up to and how they're operating. So let's assemble the conclave, head to the Citadel, teach us everything we need to know about the lands of Alwaeswinter.
Lands of Alwaeswinter. Here's a passage from the books, from book one, Game of Thrones, where Bran receives a vision from the three-eyed raven. Bran is floating high above the world. He's got a raven's eye view of this land. And this, the following occurs. Finally, he looked north. He saw the wall shining like blue crystal and his bastard brother John sleeping alone in a cold bed, his skin growing pale and hard as the memory of all warmth fled from him. And he looked past the wall, past the endless forests cloaked in snow, past the frozen shore and the great blue-white rivers of ice and the dead plains where nothing grew or lived. North and north and north, he looked to the curtain of light at the end of the world. And then beyond that curtain, he looked deep into the heart of winter, and then he cried out, afraid, and the heat of his tears burned his cheeks. "Now you know," the crow whispered, "now you know why you must live." Why? Because winter is coming. So at the end of Oathkeeper, we see a White Walker take Craster's last son on a long journey to the farthest northern reaches of the lands beyond the wall. These are the lands of Alwaeswinter. And beyond that, into the heart of winter, where we now know the White Walkers gather or have been slumbering, perhaps, as they gain strength from Craster's children and who knows who else's children before that. Once, long ago, in the Dawn Age, before the Long Night, this place, like all of Westeros, was the domain of the Children of the Forest. Later, the First Men came. We've talked about this. They walked over the land bridge from Essos into Dorne and gradually populated the entire land, chopping down the trees, chopping down the weirwood trees, forcing the old races back, including the Children of the Forest, who they engaged in a brutal and centuries-long war with. The petty tribal kings of the First Men were to be found, even in these far northern lands, ruling from ring forts, the Fists of the First Men, where the Night's Watch made their stand, or whatever you want to call it, their very, very brief stand against the White Walkers back in seasons 1 and 2, is one of these ancient strongholds. Now, we know that the children, during the centuries-long conflict against the First Men, unleashed some sort of powerful magic to shatter the land bridge between Essos and Westeros. This stemmed new migrations, but it was too little too late. Humans were already there. They were breeding, as they do. And they had bronze weapons, they had armor, they ride horses, and this was just too much for the Children of the Forest, who also, while they are very old, they reproduce at a very slow rate. In their desperation, what else might the children have done to wipe out this danger to them, to wipe out the men? We find out later, when Bran has another vision, that the children created the White Walkers somehow. Now, this is interesting because the timeline here is weird. And we're not sure if it's a show retcon or what. So the pact, the peace agreement between the children and the First Men, was sealed 10,000 years ago, about 2,000 years before the Long Night. Now, if that's accurate in the show, why the lag between the assumed creation of the Walkers and their emergence? Was this the event that created the strange cycle of seasons in Westeros? Was winter as brutal or as unpredictable as it was before the children did this? Did the children betray the peace they made with the First Men? Did they sign that peace and then go, okay, we were going to kill them anyway? Whatever the case, it's clear that the children lost control of their creations. And since the raising of the wall, the lands of Alwaeswinter have been essentially a no-go zone for wildlings, for everyone. This is where the White Walkers have been sleeping all this time.
Love this. This is just great shit. I can't wait to learn more about this in certainly seasons 7 and 8. And, you know, may there be another book one day. I would love to learn about it there.
We hope so.
It's
come on, George.
It's cool to think that, like, again, one of the things that I think Jason and I both love so much about this story is that it is at once completely unique.
Yeah.
And ambitious in a way that is really specific. and also aligned with some of the greatest traditions in sci-fi and fantasy. Right. Like, is it all that different from creating the Cylons?
Right.
And then having them wipe out humanity?
Right.
Right? If it's something like that.
Exactly.
Like, the DNA of what makes any great fantasy epic, it could be right here in this. That is pretty exciting. All right. Much more to come on that in future episodes, undoubtedly. Maester.
Yes.
A man with no motive is a man no one suspects.
A man with no motive is a man.
Let's avoid suspicion.
Sure.
Let's head to the Sept to bathe in the light of the Seven by sharing seven of our favorite insights and observations from this episode. Lightning round style, as always, you go first. What's number one?
John at Castle Black. He's training the new recruits. Locke steps up and immediately shows that he can fight. John says, is interested now in this guy. Hey, you know, what brought you here? He says, Locke says, a sense of duty. I wanted to do my part for the safety of the realm. And then they laugh. But the thing is, Locke's kind of telling the truth here.
All a matter of perspective,
I guess.
It's a
weird, perverted perspective.
Sure, sure.
But he is there according to a sense of duty.
Right, as far as his liege lord is concerned.
And in terms of safety of the realm, it's safety of his very evil house.
Right.
But he's kind of telling the weird truth there.
One of the things I really like about that interaction is that John, it's the pivot scene. He's basically saying to him, you could have gone easier on them, which is what everyone said to him
right.
in season one when he first arrived. And Tyrion's like, you know, none of those guys have ever picked up a sword. Like, you're basically being an arrogant asshole.
Yeah.
Love that. All right, number two, a little more Locke here. Yeah. When he approaches Jon and they're chatting, bonding after, and he says, bastard, eh? I took you for a highborn. What does Jon say? My father was highborn. My mother wasn't.
When I return, we will talk more.
I promise.
I promise.
More good advice from Bronn. He's fighting Jaime, training Jaime. And Jaime says, you know, Bronn uses kind of like a dirty move. Jaime says, what was that? That was me knocking your ass to the dirt with your own hand after he pulled his
hand out
and just punched him with it. You're a rare talent when you're fighting cripples anyway. You want to fight pretty or do you want to win? This is the classic, kind of like one of the core Game of Thrones lessons. Do you want to fight pretty? Do you want to be honorable or do you want to win?
We've heard this from Bronn so much. Like, yeah. Again, when he first saves Tyrion's life up at the Eyrie in the Vale.
In the Vale.
With Lysa. In season one, and you know, he's like, you don't fight with honor. That's what Liza says. I'm just like, no, he did.
Right?
And he went through the moon door after I stabbed him. Okay, so number four. The most important thing in this episode, by far, it's really not close. Sir Pounce.
Yes.
Aren't you a proper fellow?
Yeah.
It's just great. I love cats.
This is something everyone should know about.
Love cats.
Big
I have
cat
a proud cat owner. Or, you know, am I an owner? You know, really?
It's a partnership.
Yeah.
It's a relationship.
I'm invested in the cat in my life, and he's invested in me, I like to think. And Jason is an animal lover as well.
Yes.
And, you know, it's just great to see a sweet boy like Tommen.
Sweet boy.
Open his heart.
So
let
pounce.
Love into his life.
Number five. Jaime and Tyrion are talking about Joffrey's murder. And Tyrion says, Sansa's not a killer. Not yet, anyway. Foreshadowing. Also, Ollie, foreshadowing, too. I was the best archer in our hamlet. I was. You're going to put that to use there, buddy.
Fucking hate that kid.
Well, yeah, come on.
No. I will not. Come on. I will not. Number six. Okay. We got to talk about this for a minute.
Yeah, this is a big thing.
John and Sam chatting.
Yeah.
In the bowels of Castle Black before Locke interrupts them.
Also, like,
key moment.
Keep your, you know, like,
close
your head on a
door.
Keep your head on a fucking swivel, guys. This is like very, very, very sensitive information you guys are discussing. You're like, I saw them up north of the wall.
Were they with his Aunt Lysa?
Aunt Lysa in the Vale.
Before you tweeted us, we know that Bran is not in the Vale. We
just
imitating Littlefinger. Okay. Sam and John are talking, and John says, you know, they're discussing, Sam has a lot of regret already about Gilly. He's, you know, she's mad at him, and he knows it. Did he do the right thing? John says, I know how hard it is. Remember when I tried to leave, to be with Rob, to defend Ned, right? And he says, when you told me about Bran going beyond the wall, all I could think about was getting my strength back. This is after he had been peppered with arrows, so I could go and find him. Sam says, I wish I could have convinced him to come back with me. I tried. I really did. Now, there are differences between the books and the show
yes.
in general. There are a lot of them in this episode, actually.
A ton.
This is one of the really notable, interesting, and dare I say, bizarre ones?
It's a little tough.
Because
I can understand the thinking.
Sure. Sam does not tell John in the books that he sees Bran.
Right. They encounters them at the Night Fort, same as usual, and they pass, and Sam keeps it to himself.
Right. Now, why?
Right.
He doesn't he's not more loyal to Bran than he is to John. What does telling John mean? Why does this matter? Well, you have your interpretation. I have mine. Yeah. Why don't you go first?
Well, I can understand the change from the perspective that in the context of the show, it doesn't make sense that Sam wouldn't tell John.
Right.
It's just a hard, without the context of the books where you can just kind of immerse yourself in really the thoughts of these characters, it's just a lot harder lift to make the case that Sam actually wouldn't have told John about it.
I don't disagree with that.
Right.
The flip side is that it doesn't make sense that John wouldn't go find Bran.
Right, that's the thing. And it feels like the way it happens feels very abrupt.
Right. Tough one.
It's a tough one.
Quick one. Number seven.
Tyrion and Jaime again. Great scene between those two. Jaime's looking over Tyrion's new abode and he says, to tell you the truth, this isn't so bad. I was covered in my own shit for months. Perspective is important, guys. Also, I noticed Jaime not keen to bring up how he bashed in his cousin's head.
Yeah, no. I mean, when you've got feces to talk about,
right.
Who needs that?
Yeah.
Okay, guys. Each episode, we look to answer injustice with justice.
With justice.
In each episode, we also look to honor the person who played the game, advanced his or her cause. This week, the winner of our champion's purse is... Dany.
Daenerys Targaryen. A conqueror now. Twice over. But this time, really, for real. They knew she was coming. You're talking about a walled city. And she did it with very little bloodshed of her own forces. And, she really mobilized the people of Slaver's Bay to take over Meereen. She's shown herself to be a revolutionary figure, a figurehead, an icon, someone that people can believe in and that she can inspire to take really drastic action that upsets the balance of an entire region of the world. And she's growing into her own in terms of her confidence about how to rule. And she also makes a decision she's going to make a decision coming up here about her immediate future.
One of the things I like about this is, Dany's time in Meereen is divisive.
Yeah, sure. I
to put it mildly.
Well, it's one of those things that just comes, it grows out of the kind of core structure of how George built his narrative from a POV perspective. You just can't jump ahead. So she's got to be there
right.
the whole time.
Right. And so, so one of the things I like about this and one of the reasons I think that she's a worthy champion here is that regardless of how you feel about the Meereen plotline or how long it will play out, you can't really deny the growth that she's showing.
It's huge.
So she's showing her ability to adapt instantly to the circumstances that greet her. In Astapor, she needs the Unsullied. She's dealing with this foul-mouthed, belittling, bigoted, arrogant asshole. She has the dragon trick, right? The facade of what is her true agenda.
Arguably the biggest gamble of her career
the Stormlord. And then the second gamble that she makes there, of course, is just like, do you want to fight for me?
Right.
They didn't. Who knew how that would go?
You never know what they would do.
So that was one, one tact. And then in Yun Kai, entirely different, right? With Daario and the Second Sons and
the way
she deals with the Titan's Bastard and his filth. And she's adjusting and assessing her foe and responding accordingly. And then Meereen, she knows that it's not necessarily about, okay, I'm going to get this army or I'm going to recruit these cell swords and basically buy someone's allegiance. It's the people who are already there, the actual fabric of the place itself. That's a very different
Rises
thing.
To meet her.
Exactly. So that's pretty cool. And I think it shows how observant she is. Her mind actually as a tactician, which she probably doesn't get enough credit for. And ultimately, the fact that whether or not you think she makes good choices, and I do not think Dani always makes good choices.
No, she makes a lot of mistakes.
She makes a lot of really bad choices. Yeah. But I always admire the fact that she has the full strength of her conviction. And this is one of the moments where we really see her fully come into herself. You know, when Ser Barrison, who in theory she...
It's like, maybe think about not crucifying everybody.
Right, but she doesn't even pause to think about what he's saying. She says, no, I have made a decision here. This is what I want. Now, that kind of dictatorial spirit is not necessarily the way to go, the proper way
to
be guided.
It's not going to work everywhere.
But there's something admirable about her saying,
I've
what I think is right.
I've got your note. I'm going to disagree.
Going to hit that X in the Google Doc suggestion. Great stuff from Dani.
Yeah.
Okay, guys, we would hate for you to do something inappropriate. So we're going to wrap here.
Yes.
But we hope that you had as much fun as we did today and that you will join us again next time when we will be discussing season 4, episode 5, First of His Name.
Yes.
Until then, remember... There's nothing like a thoughtful gift to make a new friendship grow strong.
You don't want to spend the winter in the Vale with your aunt, Liza. No, that's no good. The North, the Boltons. I don't know much about them. That will be a plot point in later episodes, the fact that I don't know anything about them. Ramsay Bolton seems like a nice boy.